Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Things at Zaxby's just got sensational. Because now you can experience their signature Asian Zenzation flavor three different ways. Get that sweet, tangy, citrusy, zesty fusion of flavor rolled up in a giant wrap, drizzled on a salad with an egg roll, of course, or tossed on their famous chicken fingers. Hey, flavor this good deserves its own private menu. Or should I say, Zenyu. The Asian Zenzation lineup, available only at Zaxby's. Who's got the sauce?
Zaxby's.
Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
I'm Momo.
And this is Monstrous. This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised.
Yeah, because the way I got all those coats in there, it kind of radiates that way.
Mm-hmm. So I felt it before, so I kicked off. No, even though it's like 80 degrees in here.
Nice and toasty in here, isn't it?
I know, but I'm cold now. All right. Sorry, guys. So welcome back. As you heard, we're officially in the deep freeze of the holiday season.
Yeah, that's a no lie.
You know, 10 degrees outside. My house is set at 80 degrees. Nice and comfy. Except for right this second, because I'm cold.
She's only cold.
All right. So if you're anything like me, probably got one eye on the clock, the other on your gift list, because we are officially a week and a half away from Christmas. Just shy of 17 days, to be exact. That means we're only 3.5 weeks away from waving goodbye to this year entirely.
I'm glad, because this year sucked.
We're going to manifest that 2026 is everyone's year.
I certainly hope so, because a lot of people have had such a rough year.
It's been 2025 has been rough. Like,
I mean, prices have jumped, and you know, it's ridiculous.
Yep, it's been hard for everyone. Like,
especially ones like me, the senior citizens,
right,
that are on a fixed income.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything's going up, and it just makes it tighter and tighter.
Right, because your checks don't go up with it. Our pay doesn't.
We a raise once a year.
Shit, we didn't even get a raise at work this year.
You still make it more than me.
Well, yeah, but you know what? Like, how much they work us?
Oh, I know. I know.
And then for some of us, some of the departments don't work very much during the summertime.
Yep.
And we don't get a raise. So last year we got like 20 cents.
I'd take 20 cents. That's a dollar for every 5 hours.
But you get what I'm saying? Like, how much you work us and how much we bust our asses for your multi-million dollar company.
We can't even give you a free turkey or ham.
Right. Take that away. You give us a jacket. So what am I going to do with a jacket?
Wear it.
Probably not, because it's probably shit. Anyway, no, I was told it was a nice jacket. We haven't got it yet. I guess it's supposed to be one of those soft shell jackets. I was told it was really nice. Yeah. That's what the HR lady told me. That's a really nice jacket.
Mm.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, sorry, guys.
Not yet.
You guys don't care. Sorry. Sorry. Anyway.
But I'm sure they can relate.
Yeah. Yeah. This year's just been rough for everybody. So we're going to manifest that 2026 is everybody's year.
I'll second that.
Yep. Podcast is going to blow up. Everybody can have a good year. Us, the listeners, have a good year. All right. So with that, if you're traveling for the holidays, be safe out there.
From my bedroom to the living room.
Oh, my God. If you're traveling for, you know, the holidays to see family, or coming home from seeing family, or if you're winter birds that are traveling to hotter climate, if you're traveling for that, make sure you're staying safe.
Be safe
on your way to your destinations, whether
once
it's out
you
there.
Spend it with your loved ones.
It's crazy.
And not in the hospital or anything else.
It was Thanksgiving and we had snow here in Iowa. So winter is...
No, we had a blizzard.
Yep. No, this winter is going to be rough everywhere. So everyone be safe. But if you're staying home...
As we are.
And you are not traveling, pour yourself a hot drink, grab a blanket, and settle in. Because the holiday season has a way of highlighting the light. But today, we're going to be talking about the shadows instead.
Are we going to move in the shadows?
I guess you could say that.
Sweet.
We're going to be talking about the dark things that happen, even when the rest of the world is preparing to celebrate. Today's case is a prime example of a holiday season, or really any season to be exact, that is interrupted by unthinkable violence. It's a case where the more you dig into it, the more complicated and infuriating it becomes.
Oh, great. I'm going to get myself censored.
It was a weekend retreat nestled high in the Sierra Nevada mountains, a place of tall pines and silent snow. Kedu Resort, Plumas County, California. It's 1981, a small, humble community built around fishing, snow, and peace. A place where you left your doors unlocked. A place where nothing bad was ever supposed to happen. On the morning of April 19th, the peace was shattered. Three bodies were found inside cabin 28. The victims, an entire family unit, brutally bound and murdered.
Aww.
But even more chilling than the carnage was the silence that followed it. Two little boys seemingly sleeping through it all, and a teenage girl. Gone. The Katie Cabin murders became a legendary piece of California true crime, a case plagued by incompetence, secrecy, and a lingering question that has haunted the region for four decades. Who did it and why? So to understand the Katie murders, you have to understand the place and the era. The Katie Resort was located about 15 miles north of the town of Quincy. It wasn't a luxury destination. It was a cluster of 30 or so rental cabins, and it was set up for people looking for affordable living or a getaway from the city life.
Amen.
Katy wasn't just a place. It was an entire feeling. It was a remote bubble where people assumed they were safe from the outside world. The residents were a mix of families like the Sharks, seasonal workers, and folks seeking refuge from city chaos. The nearest major town to Katy, like I said, was Quincy, and it was a significant drive away, leaving Katy physically and psychologically disconnected. The narrow, winding mountain roads were often impassable in winter, reinforcing the insular mindset of the few dozen residents. They lived off the grid, quite literally, believing the remote landscape offered a shield against the darker realities of the world. By 1981, the resort was past its prime. It had become less of a vacation spot and more of a community of people living there out of financial necessity. Those who were often struggling with seasonal employment and relying upon each other. This profound sense of isolation is key to this entire case. It explains why people felt comfortable leaving their doors unlocked and why the local police force was entirely unprepared for the scale of violence that they would encounter. So the cabins, which included 26 and 28, were built close together, being separated only by a few feet. Yet, the crime managed to happen in shocking silence. Locals even nicknamed the area the Hole, due to its bowl-shaped geography, adding to the feeling of being cut off from the outside world and making the fact that no one heard anything even more baffling.
That's creepy.
So this geographic isolation meant that the primary law enforcement, which was the Plumas County Sheriff's Department, operated on a skeleton crew, primarily handling minor disputes and routine calls, which is pretty typical for
Yeah,
a small community like that. They had no experience with a crime of this magnitude at all, which I don't mean, isn't it crazy that that's how these cases happen? The major big cases like this one
is in small towns
with small, shitty law enforcement. Like, why is it that these crazy psycho murderers somehow have a radar for these tiny ass towns with shitty ass cops?
They do their research.
Is it like a third sense or something? Like, I don't understand it. Anyway, I digress.
They radar in.
Right, exactly. Like, I digress. So the department only had a handful of deputies covering thousands of square miles of rugged wilderness.
Ringleader eventually will fall out.
Right. So, and their training that these few officers had to cover all of this land was geared toward misdemeanors and not homicides. So they're,
well, they probably hadn't seen a homicide.
Well, I'm sure, but it's like you still are supposed to get the same training.
Well, yeah, but it's not like the big cities where homicides happen every day.
Right. Like,
you know, they don't get the on hand.
Right.
It's still, get all the training in the world, but the on hand is what.
A lot of it's common sense, though, too. Like, I mean, I get it. It's the 80s. That alone says a lot.
Yeah, that was 40-some years ago.
Yeah, that's...
Well, let's see.
That says a lot.
You remember you just turned 45, so it had been 44 years ago?
81, yeah. Yeah, that explains a lot, just that alone. Anyway.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
So when the call about the Keddie murders came in, the few men that were available were forced to step into a very large professional void. They lacked the specialized forensic units, dedicated evidence technicians, and even just the basic procedural framework necessary to process a complex, high trauma scene, effectively guaranteeing critical missteps before the sun even fully rose that morning. So from the very beginning, this case was fucked. Just to sum it up. Furthermore, the topography of the Keddie area is crucial. The cabins were situated on a steep incline leading down to the Feather River, meaning the crime scene was not only remote, but also inherently difficult to secure and process, complicating every subsequent step the local untrained deputy took. Yeah. The weather on the night of April 11th had been cold and clear. A crisp, almost deceptive silence that usually signified peace in the mountains, not terror. The entire atmosphere was completely unsuited for the urban level of violence that would then occur, underscoring the deep shock felt by the few officers who arrived first on the scene. So now that we've set the era and the area, we're going to get into our story. And our story for this case centers around Cabin 28. In the early spring of 1981, this cabin was home to Glenna Sue Sharp. We're going to call her Sue because that's what she went by. She was 36 years old. She and her five children moved from the Sacramento area to start fresh. So this included her 14-year-old daughter, Sheila, Tina, who was 12, Rick, who was 10, 5-year-old Greg, and 4-year-old Justin.
Oh, those little guys.
The other key resident of Cabin 28 that weekend was Johnny Sharp, who was Sue's oldest son from her previous marriage. And he was there visiting from his dad's home in Reno. He was 15. On the night of April 11th, a neighbor kid, Dana Wingate, was a 17-year-old boy who was friends with Johnny, and he was there hanging out for the night. So Dana had been driven home by Sue earlier that evening, but he had come back to the cabin on his own shortly later, cementing his fate as an unexpected addition to that evening. Because after he went home, he decided he wanted to stay the night. The evening was unremarkable. The kids watched a movie, probably argued over the remote, who was going to sleep where.
Throwing popcorn back and forth.
Right. Normal kid things. Sue had put her two youngest children, so Greg and Justin, in bed in one of the back bedrooms. Sheila, the oldest girl, had went over to cabin 26, which was just a few feet away, to spend the night at the Seabolt residence. So she was not home. This choice would ultimately save her life. But it also meant that the Seabolt children were the first outside the cabin to witness that initial terror, dragging an entire neighboring family into the heart of this tragedy.
Children shouldn't have
to be. So there are two separate families of victims in this one. In the quiet hours after midnight, Sue Sharp was likely settled in her living room, maybe watching TV, reading a book, something like that, to wind down after all of the children were in bed and the day was over.
I don't blame her.
Right, me too.
Glass of wine, fireplace.
Right.
I'd be asleep in about 5 minutes.
I'd like me some quiet time by myself, too. Sometime late that night, or in the very early morning hours, an intruder or multiple intruders entered cabin 28. When the sun came up on April 28, 1981, the truth of what happened after that intruder or intruders entered the cabin was waiting to be found. That next morning, Sunday, April 12th, the silence hung over April 28th, and it was unnerving. Sheila Sharp, Sue's 14-year-old daughter, was the one who made the discovery.
Oh, God.
When she returned to her family's cabin around 7:45 that morning, she noticed something was immediately wrong. The cabin door, which should have been a symbol of shelter, was a point of immediate alarm. The simple domestic routine of the weekend was violently shattered by the sight of a damaged screen and an open back door. The transition from the calm, cold mountain air outside to the interior scene of pure carnage was instantaneous and irreversible. The porch area was disturbed. The back door, which was usually locked, was wide open, and the screen had been ripped from its frame.
Oh, geez, Louise. They really wanted in.
Mm-hmm. Sheila found the scene in the living room, which was one of unimaginable and chaotic violence. The telephone cord had been deliberately severed, ensuring no one could call for help. And seeing this, she immediately ran back to the Seabolt cabin for help waking up her friends. It was Justin Seabolt, the Seabolt children's father, who went back with her and called the police. So we're going to imagine that moment for Sheila. The transition from the familiar, comforting quiet of a Sunday morning to a scene of absolute silent terror. The chaos inside the living room was not a sudden explosion, but instead frozen tableau of extreme violence. For the Seabolt and Captain 26, the psychological shock was equally profound. They had been sleeping just inches from where three people were being beaten and stabbed to death, yet claimed to have heard nothing. This silence, the inability to hear a murderous rampage unfold next door, created an immediate, almost paralyzing suspicion within the community, forcing investigators to immediately question the Seabolt's integrity and ability to sleep through such a horrific event, essentially dragging the family of witnesses into the suspect pool from the very beginning. However, one of the Seabolt children, Justin Jr., provided a strange piece of testimony that sent investigators down a very early rabbit hole. So he claimed he had seen a man matching the description of a local drifter outside the cabin around midnight carrying some kind of case. This testimony, combined with the fact that the entire neighboring family remained asleep during such an extreme violent occurrence, immediately complicated the narrative, forcing police to consider both an external killer and the bizarre possibility of someone inside cabin 26 also being involved. So they're not even sure if it was one person or two people or more. They have no idea. So what the first responders found inside cabin 28 quickly turned a missing persons check into a triple homicide investigation. Okay. I'm going to insert a trigger warning for everyone. We're going to go into what was inside the cabin, how everyone was found. So trigger warning for that, guys. So in the main living area, they found three bodies. Sue Sharp on the floor. She was bound with medical tape and electrical wire. Her hands were tied behind her back and a gag was stuffed in her mouth. She had suffered multiple stab wounds and blunt force trauma. Furthermore, her pajamas were partially torn or undone, and her hair, along with Tina's, which she was found later, showed signs of being cut or pulled, suggesting a violent and deeply humiliating act. So whoever did it either cut her hair or pulled it out. Yeah. Near her lay her oldest son, Johnny Sharp. He was also bound and gagged, but with shoelaces and cloth rather than tape and cord. Like his mother, he had been subjected to brutal blunt force trauma and repeated stabbing. The third victim found was Dana Wingate, Johnny's 17-year-old friend. He had not been bound, but he was found near the fireplace, also having been attacked with extreme violence, including ligature strangulation marks around his neck. Johnny and Dana were found laying side by side, suggesting that they were subdued together, possibly while trying to defend Sue. That's the belief.
Sounds about right.
So the weapons used in this attack were horrifyingly varied, suggesting a frenzy of violence or multiple attackers. The victims have been bludgeoned with a ball peen hammer.
Damn.
And a bloody steak knife was recovered from the scene. But the brutality goes beyond the sheer number of wounds that each victim had. Forensic reports later confirmed the extent of this overkill, and it's major overkill. Sue Sharp suffered over 25 stab wounds to her chest and upper body.
Somebody didn't like her.
Yes, this is a clear sign of intense and very personal rage. Like, you don't...
Yeah, because the stabbing is up close and personal.
Right. If it would have been, like, a robbery gone wrong, it would have been, like, I hate to say it this way, but it would have been, like, a one-and-done kind of thing.
Right.
Or they would have had a gun, or there wouldn't have been multiple weapons. It would not have been that level of overkill at all.
Uh-uh.
This was... It had to be someone that knew her.
And she knew them.
Had to be. Could be wrong, obviously.
But it's like I said, a stabbing is up close and personal.
Right.
And it's usually somebody you know.
Yes, it is. So,
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
It was either someone that knew her or knew the kids and wanted one of the kids. She stood in the way. Or in rare cases, it could have just been somebody who liked to do that. Who like to kill. Because there have been those cases, but this level is not very often. Ooh. Yeah. So despite this chaos, Sue was found with no money on her, which immediately told investigators that the motive was not robbery, but something far more personal and visceral. So adding to this confusion over the means of the attack, investigators later determined that while the bloodied steak knife was recovered, a second larger knife was unaccounted for and believed to have been taken from the Sharp kitchen, suggesting that at least two different cutting implements were used during the attack. So we have a ball peen hammer and two separate knives. Yeah. So from a criminal profiling standpoint, okay, for anyone that is new here, we try to explain, you know, the technical words that are used amongst law enforcement, investigative, things like that. So for anyone that does not know what overkill means from a criminal profiling standpoint, overkill is a critical feature defined as the infliction of injuries far beyond what is necessary to cause death. And in this case, Sue Sharp's numerous stab wounds, so 25, were not efficient. They were excessive and passionate, which means there was major overkill in her murder. 25 stab wounds is, you're dead before then, because it wasn't little stab, you know, they weren't superficial marks or superficial wounds. It wasn't her arms or her leg. It was in her chest and up, you know, abdomen, the whole upper part of her body. It wouldn't have taken 25 stabs to kill her.
That was all they'd have to do is hit a major organ or a major blood vessel.
Right. And where she was stabbed, that's all major organs. Major overkill hill here. So this specific detail is used by criminal profilers to suggest that the crime was not the work of a cold professional killer or a random transient, like we said, but instead a perpetrator acting out of intense personal and accumulated rage. Now, like I said before, there are some people there have been some killers that kill to this extent just because they like it. That is a fact. But overkill typically comes with it being someone you know. Those are just the statistics.
Because they're usually stabbings is a crime of passion.
Right. Because it is, you have to get up close and personal to stab somebody. So statistics show that although it does happen with people you don't know, it's not very common at all. Now, the violence was specifically expressive rather than instrumental. This means that the primary goal was the venting of hatred and humiliation toward the victim, not the purpose of ending her life. So they wanted her to die. That's obvious. But that was not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal was to humiliate her and for the killer to feel better.
Sick puppies out there.
Yeah. That's what the profilers determined anyway. It's really speculative. This is just using what is around them and what they can see. And their knowledge, obviously. So this forensic signature immediately pointed detectives towards someone known to Sue who harbored a profound and private grievance. That's where you look in any kind of case like this. You always look at the people that are closest to the victim. So this unrecovered second weapon, like I said, is a point of contention for investigators, okay? As its absence supports the theory of multiple perpetrators. But it also leans against it as well, because does one person really have multiple people that hate them so much they want to kill them?
Not generally.
Right. So while the ball peen hammer was used for blood bludgeoning, and it was found much later, it was not found initially, and the smaller steak knife was left at the scene, the missing larger knife likely belonged to her kitchen set. Why would you take one weapon, but not the other two? You leave the smaller one for it to be found right away. You take the larger knife with you, and then you attempt to hide the hammer, but still leave it to where it can be found. What kind of sense is
that? Never said that people like that are real smart.
I know. You love a stupid criminal, right? But it's like it makes you question, because like I said, how many people have enough people that hate them so much that they want them dead?
I think it was just one person.
But then you have one person. Why only take one of the weapons? Why not take all three?
Maybe the knife slipped and they cut themselves and they had their blood on.
On the big one, that's true. Maybe that's true. I didn't think about that.
I watch too many crime shows.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't even think about that. Because typically, especially in stabbing of this magnitude, there's a lot of blood.
Yeah, but they didn't say
knives get really slippery.
Yeah, they didn't say if the knife was broken or anything either.
No. No, I couldn't. It's just a smaller steak knife.
Yeah, because if it breaks, all that does is just fish off more.
Right, right.
You could grab a bigger one.
Right. So this whole thing suggests that a second assailant may have arrived, either armed or grabbed a larger, more formidable cutting implement from the family's own drawer before or during the initial assault and then carried it away with them. So we have evidence that points to one person.
But you got enough evidence to point to two people.
Right,
too.
Exactly. The more you dig into it,
the weirder it gets.
Right, the more confusing it gets because you just don't know. There's things that support both angles. So the question about this was this. Was this second knife the weapon used to transport and then dispose of Tina Sharp's body? Or was it the signature weapon of a secondary killer? The inability to ever find this critical piece of steel, likely covered in the victim's blood, has forever left a hole in the physical evidence connecting the crime to one single person. They've never found this knife.
Should they have thrown it down there in the ravine and melted?
Oh, yeah. That's probably exactly where it went.
It floated in the river.
So adding to the intensely personal nature of the crime, the medical tape used to bind Sue Sharp was not a generic type. This tape was traced back to a specific brand of surgical tape.
And that stuff's pretty strong.
Typically used by a nurse or in a medical setting. Hinting that the killer may have had specific knowledge of how to secure a person quickly and effectively. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, like I mentioned before, that forensic examination confirmed samples of Sue's hair and Tina's later recovered hair had been brutally cut with scissors or a knife, suggesting the killer took trophies or engaged in a deeply personal post-mortem mutilation.
Just take a little off the top, please.
Oh, my God. So the combination of the binding and the attack methods tells a story of both rage and control.
Right.
Sue and Johnny had been tied up using different types of ligatures, medical tape and electrical wire for Sue, shoelaces and cloth for Johnny. This mixing of methods is often interpreted by profilers to suggest either panic or multiple attackers using whatever they had at their hands. Furthermore, the cause of death for the three victims was a mixture of extreme blunt force trauma consistent with the hammer and multiple stab wounds. Dana Wingate, though unbound, showed evidence of manual strangulation or ligature marks on his neck, indicating that he may have been subdued first or brought back fiercely. So they're saying that. So he had the ligature strangulation mark. So they believe that he was either subdued with a ligature and then manually strangled, or he was subdued and then they used the ligature to basically knock him out and then let him breathe right before he died.
Rule.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the sheer length of time that it would take to inflict these multiple types of fatal wounds on three different people, bind two of them, and then stage this scene is staggering, and it speaks to the killer's cold, calculating focus, or to a sharp, sustained violence perpetrated by a group of people. Yet, perhaps the most disturbing detail of the entire scene involves the other children in the cabin.
The little ones.
In a small back bedroom, police found the two youngest boys, 5-year-old Greg Sharp and 4-year-old Justin Sharp, completely unharmed.
Oh, thank God.
They were sleeping soundly, covered by blankets, and seemingly oblivious to the horrific acts that had unfolded just feet away in the living room.
With poor babies.
This fact alone is almost impossible to reconcile with the savagery of the crime. I mean, think about it. Think about all the noise that would make. The smashing of the ball-peen hammer, the frantic screams that I'm sure happened, the heavy physical struggle of at least 4 people in a small cabin. How could such a ferocious event happen just down the hall without waking two small children.
Children are looking to have a bomb go off next to their head.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
And they'll say it's like...
It's just one of those things that is like, you know what I mean? They're 4 and 5 years old.
They were out. I mean, especially if they'd been playing outside or something. They were done.
So this chilling detail immediately forced investigators to consider a truly dark possibility. Were the boys simply asleep? Or had they been deliberately incapacitated? Were they given a sleeping pill? Or perhaps even threatened into absolute silence before the attack on their mother and sibling and his friend began?
I don't know. I can't see the one, really. Of course, I could be wrong.
Yeah, we just don't know.
Yeah, and DNA and testing stuff like that back then was still in its infancy.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that the killer or killers knew they were there and yet left them physically unharmed suggests an almost surgical focus on the three victims in the living room. Because he killed three other children, but left those two alone.
Because it's their baby.
It's like, you know what I mean? And some, I mean, everybody's got a line. And some, there have been killers in the past that we have seen on the shows that we watch.
Yeah.
Where they have killed everyone but the children. Or they will kill certain children because they are over a certain age, but not
little ones.
Right. So maybe that's the case. Maybe this guy or these guys had a line. I don't know. But the youngest boys, in a sense, became silent, unconscious witnesses to a trauma they couldn't possibly describe, forever carrying the psychological scar of the unspeakable violence that had unfolded just meters away while they slept. Now, in the master bedroom, officers found further chaos. A bloody footprint was impressed on a wooden step. This bloody print was large, possibly a size 10 shoe, but in 1981, they lacked the forensic technology that we have today to match it conclusively, leaving it as just another tantalizing but unstable piece of the puzzle. But there was still one person missing. That would be Tina Sharp, Sue's 12-year-old daughter. And she was gone. Her bed was empty, the door to her room open, but she wasn't there. In the early hours of the investigation, one of the first major failures involved the time of death analysis. So the original investigators, hampered by the forensic methods of 1981, were unable to narrow down this window. They placed the time of death in a broad, frustrating range, roughly between 10 p.m. on April 11th and 7 a.m. on April 12th.
In the body. Okay.
Mm-hmm. This 9-hour window was so wide that it essentially failed to support or definitively break the alibis of any person of interest, including the neighbors next door. So because of this 9-hour window, they couldn't rule any fucking buddy out.
No.
So like, you can't narrow it down a little bit? Help us out, guy. So this inability to pinpoint the exact time of the crime occurring immediately gave breathing room to the killer and deepened the ambiguity of the entire case. The Plumas County Sheriff's Department launched an investigation. But from the very beginning, errors were made left and right.
No shit.
Now, this was 1981. Like you said, DNA analysis was in its infancy. Police were heavily reliant on fingerprinting and traditional crime scene sketching processes, which require absolute precision. Back then, fingerprinting wasn't put into a system. They checked fingerprints.
Yeah, they didn't have coders back then.
They checked it by hand. to take pictures, a sketch artist came out and drew the picture. You had to be very, very precise back in the 80s. Photographs were taken, okay? They did do that, but they were shitty. And so because of that, because they had the Polaroid cameras back then, weren't wide, lighting was shit, sketch artists would also come out. They don't really have sketch artists, I don't think, go out to crime scenes anymore nowadays, do they?
No, because everything's digital.
Right. A lot of it's digital cameras, and a lot of I know some, a lot of counties, they actually video record it as well as take individual pictures. So they don't need sketch artists anymore. But back then, they had sketches and photographs. They were not systematic. They were not good. They were often blurry. Then the sketches were often shit. So it was just a mess all over the place. So the sheer brutality of the scene itself seemed to overwhelm the small town investigators, as I'm sure we can all expect. In the crucial first few hours, the cabin was not adequately secured, allowing personnel and neighbors to potentially contaminate or even destroy physical evidence that today's modern science could have used.
Yeah.
It's just gone. And then crucially, biological evidence, including samples that could have contained the killer's semen, was either contaminated or lost due to improper storage, eliminating the chances to ever definitively identify the perpetrator decades later using today's DNA testing.
Yeah, they've come so far with DNA that...
Back then, they used to put samples like that in paper bags.
Yeah.
They not realizing that paper bags...
Not refrigerating them to preserve them.
Mm-hmm. Paper bags, they get wet, they get moldy. Samples are no good after that. Yep. In addition to this lost physical evidence, the official transcript of Martin Smart's crucial initial interview with law enforcement was inexplicably lost from the case file. Compounding,
that doesn't surprise me.
And this compounded the errors that doomed the case to cult status from the very start. Yeah. How the fuck do you lose a suspect's interview? That happened
because they don't have the they didn't have the video recording like we do now. Honey.
I know, but it's like,
see, nowadays not only do the detectives take notes, but the room is recorded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, video and audio, which I get that, and I try to like when I do these cases, I really try to remember and understand that times are different today than they were then. But it's like, this is a triple murder case, a triple homicide here that involves two children. How in the hell do you lose a suspect interview?
Honey, back then they used to lose all kinds of shit.
It's like, I don't understand. No, anyway. So quickly, the cabin became a revolving door of tragedy and all around. Because Plumet County was so small, officers who arrived were often close friends or acquaintances of the victim, compromising their professional ability to process the scene objectively.
Yep.
Which doomed it from the start as well. They lacked formal crime scene tape, proper containment protocols, and even sufficient body bags using sheets and towels in the initial cleanup. Yeah, Mama's just shaking her head. This procedural void meant that within hours, this remote cabin, which should have been secured as a pristine container of evidence, was instead flooded by unauthorized personnel, including neighbors, the victim's family, and eventually aggressive media representatives that came from everywhere from Sacramento to San Francisco, eager to capture the sensational horror.
Oh, yeah.
So the whole fucking cabin, which should have been easy to cordon off, it's out in the middle of friggin' nowhere.
They didn't, and it got contaminated.
Yep, the whole thing, inside and out.
Yep.
The failure to establish a rigorous chain of custody and a perimeter meant that the physical scene was essentially destroyed before any forensic specialist could ever be called in from the larger Metropolitan Department, cementing the reputation of the Keddie case as a textbook example of investigative failure.
Yeah, it was definitely doomed from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. So the local law enforcement, overwhelmed by the scale of violence, which I can understand that, It's a lot. They're not trained for it. They're not used to it. I can get how you become overwhelmed. You cordon the shit off and you call in the people who can help you.
When the FBI.
You don't let every Tom, Dick, and Harry down the street that want to come in and see what the hell's going on into the cabin. God, this stuff makes me so mad. Like, you see what I mean? It's just common sense. So they took some unusual and ultimately detrimental investigative steps. They just did. Eventually, they did reach out to the FBI's behavioral science unit for assistance. But the resulting profile, which suggested the killer was likely a transient or outsider, was largely ignored by the local sheriff.
No, I'm sorry. I don't agree with that. That kind of stabbing for those people, that was up close and personal. And that was someone that knew.
Yeah. Which, let me look it up.
And the profiles aren't always right either.
No.
It's an educated guess.
Right. Which the BSU, the FBI's BSU, had only been around for 9 years.
Yeah. It was still in its infancy.
Right. So they're still learning this stuff, because how the BSU figures out the things that they use to profile is by talking to killers. They talk to serial killers. They talk to mass.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Murderers. They talk to them. They learn about them. And that is how they're able to do these profiles. And only 9 years in, they're still figuring these things out. So in the early days, they got a lot of things wrong. So, like I said, the local sheriff ignored this. And they remained fixated on local suspects. So the local sheriff refused to look at anyone that was not local, which I can get where the sheriff is coming from, but that's a failure as well. So furthermore, in a controversial move typical of the era, okay, one of the young surviving children was subjected to hypnosis in an attempt to recover any suppressed memories of that night.
Oh, geez, Louise.
Mm-hmm. Now, this traumatic procedure yielded no reliable testimony and added a dark footnote to the police's handling of the child victim.
I can tell them that.
Yeah. Right. Idiot. So this initial mishandling would become a major roadblock, ensuring that the critical question of who committed these savage murders would go unanswered for decades. Now, the initial shock of the discovery quickly gave way to the complex, painful reality for the survivors and the frustrating reality for the investigators. The victims of Cabin 28 were not just statistics. The violence inflicted upon all three was savage and intensely personal. The immediate survivors faced an unimaginable trauma, and the initial investigation systematically looked at close family. For instance, Sue Sharp's ex-husband, James Sharp, he was immediately investigated due to the domestic nature of the crime, but he was quickly cleared based on a solid alibi out of state.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to do it when you're not there.
Right. So while the local authorities struggled with the complexity of the scene, like I said, they quickly established that James Sharp could not have physically committed the crimes because he was living in Reno, Nevada at the time and had irrefutable proof, including witness accounts and work documentation, placing him hundreds of miles away during that 9-hour window. So his swift exclusion helped narrow down the field, but it also forced investigators to immediately shift their focus to the residents of Petty, confirming early on that the monster responsible was likely not just a ghost from Sue's past, but a neighbor lurking in her presence. So the primary focus of this initial investigation, and still the most compelling theory today, centered around two specific individuals. This was Martin Smart and John Beau Boudet. Smart and Boudet lived in Cabin 26, right next door to the Sharks. Martin Smart was known to have a temper, and John Beau Boudet was Smart's temporary roommate. their initial statements provided to the police was a very vague alibi. This further complicated the initial local focus because both Smart and Boudet reportedly failed their polygraph examinations early in the investigation. Now, we all know polygraphs are unreliable and they are inadmissible in modern trials. They have been shown to not always be correct, and they're just not reliable. It depends on many things. Medications the person's taking, what kind of stress are they under? It depends on the person that is giving the exam. All of those things matter. So you can't use them in court today. But in 1981, this was enough to solidify their status as the prime focus of the Tacoma County Sheriff's Department. So we're going to talk about these two prime suspects for a minute. Because understanding their history is vital to understanding what motive they would have. Martin Smart was Sue Sharp's neighbor, like I said, living in cabin 26. And his relationship with his estranged wife, Marilyn, was known to have been volatile and abusive. Martin had a known history of violence, not just an explosive temper, but violence. He had also had recent personal tension with Sue over some small debts or some kind of neighborhood dispute, which suggested a motive rooted in personal rage and proximity. His roommate, John, presents an even darker profile. Boudet was a transient friend of Smart, a man shrouded in mystery and rumored to have deep ties to organized crime in the Chicago area before going to California. He was significantly older than Smart, which added a layer of control and darkness to their partnership. Because typically in killer duos, one is older and has a much more domineering personality than the other. The theory is that Boudet may have assisted Smart, bringing a potential professional edge or cold-blooded calculation to an otherwise heat-of-the-moment rage killing. Which that could have been, that could explain the different weapons.
Yeah. Could explain the overkill, too.
Yep, and it could explain why one weapon is missing. So the violence was so intense, so we have the bindings, the gagging, the variety of the weapons used, that investigators seriously considered the involvement of a highly unstable or professionally ruthless second party, which would have been Bo or John. The domestic issues between Smart and Marilyn, we're going to circle back to that, Sue had willingly helped Marilyn escape her abusive husband.
So it might have been a revenge killing, too.
Mm-hmm. And the violence that was unleashed that night paints a picture of a revenge killing against Sue, with the others just being victims of convenience, or perhaps because they were witnesses.
Collateral damage.
Right. Adding to the controversy.
But it would explain why they didn't touch the little one.
Right. Because they were asleep. They had no idea what was going on. Mm-hmm. So adding to the controversy of this case, later on, investigators discovered that Sheriff Doug Thomas, the man leading the 1981 investigation, had a prior personal relationship with Martin Smart.
That could explain some screw-ups.
Yep. Thomas had previously lived in Cabin 28 and stated that Smart was a great pal. Smart even alleged that Thomas allowed him to temporarily live in Cabin 28 when he was having marital problems. So this long-standing friendly relationship between the prime suspect and the lead investigator has led to decades of speculation regarding whether Thomas's team was willing or even able to pursue Smart as vigorously as an unbiased outside agent would have, potentially explaining why the strong early leads against the suspect were not fully pursued.
He should have recused himself.
Well, that's hard because pretty much everyone on the force knew all of them.
Yeah, that's true.
But that's what I was saying. They all should have stepped back and had an outside agency come in and take over. They should have handed it off from the very beginning. They should have never touched it.
It was too close to home.
Yep. So in the days following the discovery of the bodies, Martin Smart was observed exhibiting suspicious and highly uncharacteristic behavior. Despite the severe trauma and police presence in the tiny resort, Smart suddenly abandoned his truck and abruptly left Keddie entirely, moving to Reno and then eventually to the Sacramento area. So he's just like, nope, fuck this place, and just up and left. Like, you're suspicious, my guy.
Very. Isabel's at it again.
I know. Now, this was not a move driven by fear, but rather an apparent effort to distance himself from the murder location and the ongoing investigation. Then, even more damning, a friend of Smart later recounted that in the weeks after the crime, Smart had approached him and asked him to dispose of a knife and a hammer for him, claiming they were, quote, hot, and he needed them to disappear.
But the hammer was left in the cabin.
Mm-hmm.
Unless there was two.
Possibly. But this just shows how big this case was. The hammer was found in the cabin. So was there a second hammer? Or is this person just making shit up? Nobody knows. Yeah.
Half a dozen ones stick to the other.
Mm-hmm. This whole case is, it was botched from the very beginning.
No shit.
So this account was only anecdotal, but it aligns perfectly with the known murder weapons. There was a missing knife. So like you said, was there a second hammer? Now, the Pluma County's Sheriff's Department fixated on the theory of a single local perpetrator. They were like, it's got to be one person.
No, I think it was more.
I think so, too. So adding to the confusion, an early profile developed by an investigator suggested that the killer was likely a transient, like I said, or someone unfamiliar to the victim, which. Like
no,
we said, that's not
that
possible. Yeah, there's just no way. This was a finding that was largely dismissed by the then Sheriff Doug Thomas in favor of the resident suspect. So the sheriff, no matter how fucked up his decisions were, didn't even agree with this profiling. He was like, no, it's not possible. Now, this focus was persistent even after a man known as the Drifter or a similar transient hitchhiker was questioned and cleared, still leaving the door open to an unknown external killer. So this man around town known as the Drifter, they did bring him in. They did question him, but he was one of the few people they could clear. But
he was probably sitting in their jail at the time.
Probably. Okay. So this narrow focus on a local perpetrator only may have caused investigators to overlook or insufficiently follow other leads. They fully believed that whoever did this was local and local only.
No, I don't think so.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner. So you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
I could be wrong too.
Right. But it could have been anybody that knew she was up there.
Yeah.
They didn't have to be from Keddie. Yet the failures surrounding the initial investigation weren't just about poor forensics, okay? There was a layer of local drama and suspicion about an active cover-up as well. So Martin Smart's wife, Marilyn, was reportedly out of town the night of the murder. But police eventually focused on the male suspect, Marilyn Smart, was also briefly considered as a suspect herself due to the domestic turmoil and the intensely personal nature of the knife attack. Which I don't buy that either.
I don't either. I don't think she had anything to do with it.
Right, because Sue helped her leave her abusive husband. Why would she then turn around and kill her? That doesn't make any sense. That makes zero sense. However, when she returned, she became a central tragic figure, like I said. So beyond the Smart and Bobaday theory, the nature of the crime and the failures of the investigation on several other terrifying and enduring alternative theories. The one major theory suggests that the crime was linked to organized crime or drug trafficking. Even Bobaday's rumored Chicago ties which some speculated that Johnny Sharp and Dana Wingate, who were teenagers, but known to dabble in some, you know, small-time local drug sales, had witnessed something that they shouldn't have, or that the cabin was targeted by mistake in a drug dispute. But I don't buy that, because typically everyone is killed.
Yeah, they'd have killed them too.
Right. That wouldn't have mattered. So I don't think that's the case here either. Now, the intense punitive nature of the attack aligns with violence meant to send a warning, rather than just a simple robbery gone wrong.
I don't think it was a robbery.
No, it was definitely not a robbery, because nothing was, from what they could tell, nothing was, what I could see anyway, nothing was said to have been missing. I don't see who the warning would be to.
Unless it was one of the boys.
Yeah, but who would they be warning? They killed the kid's mom. You know what I mean? Who would they be warning by killing him? That doesn't make any sense. The Chicago tie doesn't make any sense, because everyone would have been killed. Child or not, they would.
No, now, a lot of times the gangsters, they wouldn't, they'd have about killing small children.
But why would they then also kill the teenagers? Do you get what I'm saying?
Because like, teenagers are mouthy.
It's just, I just don't buy it.
Yeah.
I really don't.
It just
don't
sound
it.
Right.
No. Not only that, it's too messy. It's too messy. It's too up close and personal.
Yeah. Nah.
Typically when it's...
Besides that, the gangsters would just damn shot them.
Right. That's what I was saying. It was too up close and personal. Typically when it comes to cartels and things like that,
they get one and done.
Exactly. It's
so
not,
to speak.
It's not a, I'm going to stab you and hit you with a hammer and all of this.
Yeah, no.
It would have been real quick, in and out.
They wanted it as clean as possible.
Right, exactly. This was not clean.
We definitely watched too many cops.
I know we do. This was not clean in any way. This was not organized killing in any kind of way.
No, this was not organized at all.
No.
This was a frenzy.
Oh, yeah. A sloppy one at that. One that could have easily been solved. But, you know. Anyway. So, another endearing theory centers on a transient serial killer.
Now, that could be possible.
Mm-hmm. Because the initial profile suggested that it was an outsider. And given the lack of obvious connection between the victim and the level of overkill.
Yeah, but an outsider... They wouldn't have ripped that door down, the screen off.
I don't know. Look what Ted Bundy did. With the sorority girls.
Yeah,
Blunged them with a fucking
I'm not talking about that, honey. You said the screen door was ripped up.
Was ripped out of the screen, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. A transient wouldn't have done that. They'd have knocked on the door to try to get food, drink, whatever. And he got an opportunity when the door got open.
But they didn't let Ted Bundy in the house. He got in himself.
Ted Bundy was one of a kind.
But you get what I'm saying? Like, and who knows? Because the three of them, they were in the living room. So clearly they were awake. They were up at the time.
Yeah.
He could have gone in and they could have shut the door. Green door could have been locked and he couldn't have opened it. So rip the screen out to get through the screen door.
And there's so many scenarios.
I mean, we all know how easy it is to rip a screen out of a damn door.
Yeah.
Especially old ones like that. They're just put in by a little freaking piece of rubber. You push on it hard enough and the damn thing pops right out.
Well, yeah, I know.
So, and that's why this case is so frustrating, and why them botching it from the beginning is why it is left where it is.
Yeah.
Because there's so many possibilities, and all the evidence points to so many different things. Okay, so given the lack of obvious connection between the victims and the level of overkill, because there is nothing that shows why there was that much overkill. Some believe that the killer was just passing through the isolated area.
Yeah.
And it just kind of...
But if he was just passing through, he wouldn't know who was in what cabin.
That's what I'm saying. They think that he just kind of picked one.
No, I don't know.
That one you can see how it would be possible, but then again, there's other things where it's like, I don't know. Now, this fear was fueled by the remote location, obviously, and the terrifying arbitrary nature of the violence. If it wasn't smart, it was a killer who arrived silently, took lives, and then vanished back into the vast, lonely wilderness. The failure of the local authorities to secure the crime scene effectively ensured that any evidence left by a transient killer was lost forever. So now, I've mentioned Tina Sharp a few times and how she was just gone. So we're going to circle back to her. For 3 years, her fate remained the biggest mystery in this case. So this brings us to the most frustrating failures of the initial investigation that there is. Early on, an anonymous letter was allegedly received by authorities claiming to know the location of Tina Sharp's body in exchange for the $10,000 reward that was being offered. This critical lead was checked by a deputy, but only one small corner of the vast area that was mentioned in that letter was searched.
I talk about lazy.
This failure to thoroughly investigate what was potentially the only tip regarding the missing girl resulted in Tina's disappearance dragging on for years.
They ever find her?
Then, in April of 1984, the mystery of Tina's disappearance came to a devastating close. A bottle collector discovered a human skull. Dental records quickly confirmed that the remains belonged to Tina Sharp. So they potentially could have found her.
Yeah.
Alive. Because they didn't kill her at the cabin and then take her body elsewhere, but leave everybody else. They took Tina Sharp alive. Had they handled this case correctly, they potentially could have found her. Or at least found her early enough to possibly get evidence to solve this and figure out who did it. Yeah. So this further compounded the investigative failures of this entire case. The area where Tina's remains were found were approximately 3 miles from Cabin 28 in the Feather Falls National Forest. And it had been searched previously.
Apparently not very good.
Yep. Investigators later realized that a deputy had collected what was believed to be part of a human jawbone near the scene the day after the murder, but had incredibly misidentified it as belonging to an animal. So the day after the murder, a deputy found what they thought was a human jawbone and then was like, oh no, this belongs to an animal. But it wasn't. It was an actual jawbone of a human. This crucial bone fragment had been misfiled in the evidence locker for 3 years. A catastrophic clerical error that prevented the immediate realization that Tina Sharp was deceased and that her remains were close to the cabin, denying their family closure and allowing the killer to walk free for 3 more years. Yeah. The strongest modern evidence pointing towards Sharp, or Smart, came years after the crime. Now, both Smart, who died in 2000, and Bobade, who died in 1988, took their secrets to the grave. The case would have died with Smart in 2000, except for a crucial piece of evidence recovered years later by Deputy Mark Gamberg, and that was the letter. This letter, which investigators believe was written by Smart to his wife, Marilyn, was a chilling, veiled admission. In this note, Mark repeatedly states,
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
That he had, quote, paid the price for what he did to the sharks, and that he regretted having hurt Marilyn. While not a direct or admissible confession, the tone and specific language combined with the other evidence has convinced modern investigators that Smart was in fact the killer. It was a secret admission of guilt hidden in a pile of personal effects. And then there's the final irrefutable link, the ball peen hammer. Another critical piece of physical evidence emerged in the 2000s when a key investigator found an old evidence log mentioning that missing ball peen hammer. Because it went missing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't tell you that. Yeah. The result confirmed the DNA match to both Sue Sharp and Tina Sharp on that hammer. This hammer was discovered years after the murders. Oh, no, it didn't go missing. I told you they would find it later.
Yeah.
Yeah, I told you they would find it later. I'm going to tell you how they found it. Okay. So the DNA on that matched both Sue and Tina, right? This hammer was discovered years later after the murder. It was found wrapped in paper and placed in the dirt near the resort. This evidence is the strongest link yet to establish proof and connecting the scenes. A direct DNA link from the victims to the physical weapon, which Smart later essentially confessed to misplacing in his letter. Mm-hmm. So the DNA analysis conducted in the mid-2000s utilized mitochondrial DNA. This is effective on older degraded samples like the blood samples on the hammer. Mitochondrial DNA is passed down maternally, which allows forensic scientists to definitively link the degraded blood on the ball peen hammer to the maternal lineage of both Sue and the later found remains of Tina. This advanced testing was the scientific nail in the coffin for the transient killer theory, proving the weapon used in the living room was also directly connected to the victim whose body was taken and disposed of miles away. Despite this overwhelming physical evidence linking the primary suspect, Martin Smart, directly to the murder weapon, prosecutors were unable to pursue a murder charge. In California, homicide does not have a statute of limitations, like it just about every jurisdiction that I know of.
Yeah, me too.
However, the crucial evidence against Smart, which is primarily his alleged confession letter and the anecdotal evidence about him asking a friend to dispose of a weapon, is not considered strong enough to overcome the barrier presented by his death. So they can't say, okay, yes, he's dead. We know for sure it was him. We're going to close it. They can't do that. There's nothing definitively saying it was him. Everything is circumstantial.
Yeah.
Furthermore, lesser charges relating to the abandonment and disposal of Tina Sharp's body, such as kidnapping or concealing evidence, were subject to the statute of limitations that was in effect in the early 1980s. So this meant by the time the hammer was forensically confirmed and the letter was recovered in the 2000s, the only viable charge the investigators could have pressed against the living Smart beyond capital murder were already legally time barred. And that adds a final bitter layer of the judicial failure to the case. So they couldn't do shit. Yep.
Yeah, they didn't have anything really forensically
nope. To
connect them to the murder.
Nope. So that brings us to the end of the evidence, which forces us now to look back and ask the ultimate question. What was the motive? The story of the Keddy Cabin murders is complex because the evidence points to multiple overlapping motives. When we look at all the details that we've discussed today, the sheer violence, the different victims, and the unusual staging, we can break the attack down into three distinct acts, suggesting either two killers or a single killer with shifting intentions. So first is the fact that the evidence of overkill is overwhelming. Sue suffered over 25 stab wounds. Her clothes were partially torn and her hair was cut or pulled out. This speaks to an intensely personal rage-filled attack, almost certainly by someone she knew and who felt a deep personal grievance, a profile that aligns perfectly with Martin Smart. Why would a stranger take the time to bind her, but then also cut her hair? that speaks to humiliation, not just murder.
And there's no log in humiliation.
Right. There'd be a lot of people in jail if there was.
No shit.
Mm-hmm. Then this leads us to, if Sue was the primary target, the teenagers were just collateral damage. Johnny and Dana were found side by side, suggesting that they were subdued quickly and perhaps while defending Sue. Their murders and the subsequent abduction of Tina Sharp represent a calculated act of covering up the initial crime. So think about that for a second. Why bind the mother with electrical cord but the son with shoelaces? Does that suggest two people acting with different levels of preparation or simply panic?
Well, what blows my mind is that Dana, right? They didn't bind him, you know, nope. They didn't tie him up.
Nope. So it also makes you wonder, was
the end was a bludgeon.
No. Nope. He was strangled.
Which makes it up close and personal too.
Mm-hmm. So it makes you wonder, was Johnny tied up after the fact to save it? Because it's shoelaces.
Could be.
Was Johnny hit over the head? And then Dana, you know, put into a chokehold or strangled from behind with a cord of some kind? Or a shoelace?
There's so many possibilities.
Right. And finally, we have the bizarre staging of the knife and fork driven into the doorframe.
What?
Yeah, I didn't tell you this one. This detail prevents the case from ever having a clean motive.
No kidding, because that just totally blows everything out of the freaking water.
Yeah. It wasn't necessary for the murder. It wasn't a cover-up. And it wasn't a standard part of domestic rape. It suggests a message, a signature, or a dark flourish by a killer who was perhaps mocking the investigators or sending a private, twisted threat to someone outside the cabin. This bizarre signature, the knife and fork driven into the doorframe, is the true ghost of Ketty. It hints at a meaning that was either private to the killer or directed at the victim for a transgression we will never know. It stands as a chilling symbol of the killer's detachment and permanent, maddening question mark that prevents any neat conclusion, transforming the murder into a ritualistic message that remains unread.
This is blowing my mind.
Mm-hmm. It's a wild one. So the failure to connect these three acts forensically in 1981 is why the case remains tragically unsolved in court today. Because you can easily break it down. We just did it. But you can't tie the three together.
Uh-uh.
One by itself gives you a suspect. But not one suspect meets all three.
Nope.
Despite the overwhelming modern evidence against Martin Smart, he can't be held accountable.
Not because he's dead.
Well, even if he was dead, they could close it. Say, we know it was him, but they can't.
Because he hasn't been charged or...
There's nothing definitively saying he did it.
No. Yeah. Where says that letter?
Mm-hmm. And who knows what he was talking about? Only God knows what he did to the shark.
Well, I don't believe in God. But...
You know what I mean? Like, he could have stole something from them or... You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He may not have been talking about actually killing them. Who knows what he was talking about? So this is a painful reminder that even the most dedicated work by later investigators, like Deputy Gamberg, cannot always overcome the chaos and combination of those first few critical hours. The shock of the crime immediately shattered the sense of security in Quincy and other nearby Sierra Nevada communities. Doors that were once left unlocked were suddenly bolted shut, and the once trusting neighbors became instantly suspicious of one another, a psychological wound that lingered for decades. The immediate survivors faced an unimaginable trauma. Sheila Sharp, Justin, and Greg were quickly placed with relatives and moved permanently out of the Ketty Resort area. The long-term struggle of their surviving children underscores the relentless ongoing pain of this unsolved crime. The reality is that Martin Smart was never formally charged, allowing him to die a free man in 2000, taking any chance of a courtroom resolution with him. Likewise is said for John Beau Bidet. The mysterious roommate with the rumored Chicago mob ties died of natural causes in Montana in 1988, having never been fully vetted for his past. The inability to prosecute either suspect, despite decades of work and overwhelming modern DNA and circumstantial evidence, stands as the final agonizing failure of the Keddie case. It means that while investigators know who the killer was,
they have no way to prove it.
Or they believe they know who it was, shall I say.
They have no way to prove it.
Right. The surviving Sharp children have been permanently denied the finality of a conviction, leaving the final chapter of their mother's and siblings' murder forever closed only by death, not injustice. This lack of judicial consequence is the enduring tragedy of what is the Keddie murder case. The evidence is there. The suspects are known, yet the statute of limitations has expired, and the primary perpetrators escape the one verdict that matters, a guilty conviction delivered in a public courtroom. The law failed the Sharps not once, but multiple times, in the initial contamination of the case, in the lost evidence, and ultimately in the inability to deliver legal accountability before the killers drew their last breath. This case is a This case is a painful example of how administrative negligence and procedural failures can eclipse the truth, securing permanent impunity for the guilty. 40 years later, the cabin is gone. It was eventually demolished by the county, erasing the physical reminder of the violence. The resort's reputation as a safe, quiet getaway was shattered. The murders effectively killed the local economy and accelerated the abandonment of the entire complex.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
Now, today, Keddie Resort is a haunting shell of what it once was. Cabin 28 was raised in 2004, but the resort infrastructure itself was never rebuilt or repurposed. The remaining buildings, which includes the old lodge, the general store, and the other rental cabins, stand empty. Perpetually silent monuments to the crime. The entire resort complex is now privately owned and barricaded. The roads leading in often are blocked by snow and neglect for months at a time. The local community has actively worked to forget the name Keddie, and what remains is a chilling, overgrown landscape. It is not just an abandoned development. It is a physical location permanently poisoned by the violence, forever reflecting the cold and hard isolation that allowed four people to be killed and a young girl to be taken without a single neighbor hearing a sound. But the image of that small remote cabin in the Sierra Nevada mountains, the terrifying silent violence that took place within its walls on a cool spring night in 1981, remains one of the darkest unsolved mysteries in California history. And that is the Keddie Cabin Murders.
That's crazy. I'm glad I don't live in California no more.
Right?
There's too many serial killers and crazy people.
I know. Fuck that.
Well, I lived there, 20 years?
I know. If I lived there, I was like, what, four?
Yeah, for like 6 months.
Yep. And I went back to North Carolina. That's why people here look at me and think I'm crazy whenever it's cold. And I tell them, oh, if it's below like 70 degrees, I can't, nope. Mm-mm. I'm freezing.
Oh, well, that's because you got, you're low on iron and that'll do that.
Not just that, but I grew up everywhere I lived was hot.
Well, North Carolina's not hot. I mean, it can get cold down there.
Well, it can get cold, but not cold like this.
Oh, hell no. This is ridiculous.
It don't snow normally down there till after January. And
they're getting snow now.
Up in the mountains, yeah. Papa said it was supposed to, but I don't think they're supposed to get very much. He said it was supposed to get like 1 inch. Shit, that'll hit the ground and be gone by daybreak.
Yeah, but yeah, I remember the people down there, they know that they stupid.
Right, but up in the, now in the mountains, they get a lot of it.
Yeah.
Up in like Boone and Asheville and all that, they get a lot of it.
Yeah.
But it's higher up, so.
Yeah, it's a higher elevation.
Right. But it's like, they look at me like I'm crazy because it's fucking October And I'm walking around in pants and sweaters and shit. It's cold.
Well, it gets cold to me too, honey. I walk around with a sweater on.
They look at me like I'm crazy. It's not that cold. What? It's 50 degrees outside. What do you mean it's not cold? No, it's not that bad.
Yeah, you and I are the only ones that know to go grocery shopping in 19 degree weather.
I didn't even want to do that, but I had to. We needed food in the house. And I'm not about to send Mike to the store.
No, because only God knows what he'd come back
right.
with.
Right. He'd come back with everything but what was on the list.
We can send the boys.
Hell no.
No. They're too little.
They come back with candy and soda and all kinds of crap.
V-Bucks and...
Mm-hmm. Me, everybody looks at me like I'm crazy. Back home in October, we're still grilling. It's still nice out. Hell, we have Thanksgiving outdoors back home. Can't do that shit here. Hell, it snowed this year.
Yeah, but it didn't snow. We didn't get hardly any snow last year.
No.
We got more snow in one day than we did all last year.
I know, but it was really cold last year.
It was cold, but it wasn't. We didn't have the snow.
No. Fuck all that. Hell. Oh. Anyway. Sorry, guys. I know you guys don't care. So
they can probably relate.
Probably. So if you have any information about the Katie Cabin murders, Sacramento, you can contact the Sacramento County Coroner's Office at 916-874-9257. I know this is a decades-old case. The perpetrator is dead or is likely dead at this point, whether it's Smart or someone else. But if you do know anything and can help close this case, it will bring peace of some sort to
yeah,
the surviving
children.
Yeah,
those boys, let's see. Those boys are in their early to mid-40s now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not much older than Mike, because Mike was born in 88.
Yeah.
So they're still fairly young, you know? That'll help bring them some peace. I will place this contact information in the episode description and on our Facebook page, so it's easy to find, like I do with every case like this. Maybe someday they'll be able to find the answers in this, as many of the cold cases nowadays are finally being solved just due to the advancement.
Yeah, but they have no forensic stuff. So I seriously doubt this case would ever be.
I doubt it, unless someone comes forward and says,
right,
and has, you know, something.
And I hope somebody does, because you know what? Those two little boys deserve answers.
Right. Every cold case deserves to be closed, no matter how many years it's been. Every case should be closed. Whether the perpetrators can be taken to court or not.
Or prove, if they're dead, prove they did it.
Right.
So the family can get some, the boys can get some kind of closure.
Right, exactly. Because a lot of cold cases, the perpetrators are dead now. But the families know. They know what happened. And for a lack of better words, they're able to move on.
They're kind of stuck right there in 1981, you know. Mm-hmm.
It's a limbo phase. It's never, you never move on. You're never over it. It's something that lives with you.
They need some
forever.
Healing.
But you at least know.
Yeah, they need some healing. They really do.
And you're able to fully grieve.
Yeah.
You're finally able to heal from it. Because you know what happened and
right.
You know who did it. So, and that's happening with a lot of cases now today. Cold cases are finally being solved thanks to all the advancement and everything that we have today. So maybe someday that will happen in this case.
You never know.
Right. We'll just have to watch and see what's going on. And that's it. That's all we got for this episode. Our email and Facebook, along with that contact information, is going to be in the description, like it always is. Send us your emails. Check out our Facebook page for updates and photos that go along with each of our episodes. And we'll be back next week with another deep dive into the shadows of true crime. But we are moving thousands of miles and decades away, trading the quiet isolation of a California cabin for the brutal, unforgiving isolation of the Ural Mountains in the Soviet Union. So join us next week as we investigate a case where the primary suspects are the elements themselves. Or so we think. We'll examine the shocking discovery of 9 experienced young hikers found miles from civilization. What drove them to literally slash their way out of their tent into the dead of the Russian winter? run barefoot into a freezing blizzard, and ultimately die not just of hypothermia, but of a chilling combination of massive internal injuries, fractured ribs, and crushed skull. We'll pore over the unsettling forensic, the strange lack of external struggle, the bizarre detail of victims found with radiation on their clothes, and the horrifying final injuries. So get ready to bundle up. You'll need it for this one, because the mountain we are traveling to, the locals call the Dead Mountain. It's a case where every step forward only leads to a deeper, colder mystery.
Wrong. No, I stay cold enough as it is. Thank you.
So, we will see you guys next week for that one. You got anything else?
Nope. I don't have nothing.
All right. Well, that's all we got for this week, guys. Until then, we hope you keep listening and remember to
watch out for monsters.
And don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.